16 hours of negotiations and a glimmer of hope for Ukraine, particularly the East. The Normandy Four, made up of leaders of France, Germany, Russia and Ukraine, reached a comprehensive pact, putting in place a ceasefire and a roadmap for a final solution. But the pact has left us with more questions than answers. Will this truce hold? Will the Kiev government and the militia leaders be able to agree on the finer details? And what of Russia, its sanctions and the expansion of NATO? Stay with us in this edition of The Debate as we try and answer some of these questions.
A fresh ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, one that is going to stifle the rifles in the conflict zone. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President François Hollande, his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian leader Petro Poroshenko have agreed to ease the tensions in Donbas. The new roadmap that calls for an immediate ceasefire and a heavy weaponry pullout comes after hours-long crunch discussions in the Belarusian capital.
And we've been able to agree on a lot of things. The first thing is a ceasefire starting at the midnight on the 15th of February. The second thing that I think is very important is the withdrawal of Ukrainian troops from today's contact line and the withdrawal of Donbas militia from the line specified on the 19th of September last year. There is also the political settlement. There is the constitutional reform, taking into account the rights of the people who live in the Donbas region.
But Poroshenko says the two regions won't be autonomous at the end of the day.
Despite firm insistence from Russia, we didn't agree to any status of autonomy for eastern Ukraine. We will do this through constitutional reforms of decentralization that will concern the whole country.
The four leaders, also known as the Normandy Four, reached the deal following non-stop tough negotiations, raising hopes for a complete ceasefire.
One can say that this initiative has been worth it, that in the end, President Putin has put pressure on the separatists.
I think there is hope, serious hope. Even if everything hasn't been accomplished yet, it means serious hope for Ukraine. It's also a relief for Europe.
The agreement was also signed by Donetsk and Luhansk representatives, who say they are ready to give Kyiv another chance this time.
If the leaders guarantee that the changes that are stated in the agreements ensure that Ukraine changes under pressure of Donbas, we can't help but give Ukraine this chance.
Despite hopes in Minsk, Kyiv and Donbas are wary. It seems neither side trusts the other. Ira is a resident of the Ukrainian capital. She says she doesn't think the fighting will stop. Tatiana, a local lawmaker in Donetsk Republic's assembly, says she can't be optimistic because every time fighting resumes right after ceasefire agreements. Despite this agreement, mutual distrust remains entrenched between the warring sides. The deal in Minsk may silence the guns temporarily, but to end the war, trust is a core ingredient that will make a durable solution.
Well, joining us in this edition of The Debate is Mike Billington. He's with the Executive Intelligence Review, and he joins us from Washington. And from Boston is research associate with the MIT, Jim Walsh. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us here on Press TV. Now, Mr. Billington, I'd like to start off with you, if I may. First of all, how different is this agreement from the one reached in September? Why so much hope and optimism centered around this one?
Well, there are different particulars, but it's the same basic pattern. Mr. Lavrov, the night before the meeting in Minsk, said that one of the problems with the failure to follow the original Minsk agreement was that it was supposed to include economic policies whereby Kyiv would stop the punishment of the eastern Ukraine and restore payments and pensions and so forth. That never happened. And in fact, they moved their troops up and began shelling cities almost immediately. That's liable to happen again. It's not clear how this is going to work. I think the big difference is that while Mrs. Merkel was one of the leading cheerleaders to Obama and London's efforts to start a war with Russia over Ukraine, until recently. I think she finally recognized that when Obama started talking about arming Kiev, that indeed we were on the brink of a war. And Germany's lived through a couple of other wars in Europe and finally agreed with Mr. Hollande, who has quite publicly denounced the sanctions against Russia and called for ending those sanctions, so that the two of them together were able to go and talk with Putin and Poroshenko, who is not Yatsenyuk. He's more open to discussions with Russia. And I think this time you have a growing recognition across Europe that this is not just a war in Ukraine. This is the threat of a war with Russia. And all of the Europeans know that this is a disaster. And finally, they're beginning to wake up to the fact that Obama and his British controllers are willing to risk that war to try to break the alliance of Russia and China and India and the others in the BRICS alliance, to break that, to maintain the kind of power of the Western financial system over the world at a time where the Western financial system is in complete shatters, where Europe and the U.S. are in the midst of an incredibly serious financial breakdown.
Okay,
which,
Mr. Billington, let me bring in Mr. Walsh into this discussion. Mr. Walsh, do you see it this way as well? Is this basically Europe waking up and uniting behind a peace accord over here? Because 16 hours of negotiations and three separate news conferences were held. Many are viewing that as a lack of unity between the players.
Well, you know, I think you led off by asking, is there a hope and optimism? I think there's hope. I don't think there's a lot of optimism. And I don't think this is sort of silly, this notion that suddenly the French and the Germans are trying to stop the U.S.-British war machine. I mean, where did that come from? But let's just take this one thing at a time. I think you get ceasefires because all the parties want them. And in this case, if this ceasefire holds, and that's a big if this ceasefire holds, it's because the Ukrainians want the ceasefire, and I think because the Russians want the ceasefire for very, very different reasons. I think the rebels are probably happy to continue fighting, but I think Putin has tremendous leverage over the rebels, and he can enforce a ceasefire if he's inclined to. What does Putin want? Putin doesn't want a Ukraine that enters NATO and enters the EU. That's his chief objective. He knows that they're not going to, regardless of what the rebels want, they can't take over the entire country. And I think Ukraine wants a pause right now. They've been losing in recent months. It's about to enter the muddy season anyway, so it makes sense for a lot of reasons that for all the parties to pause and back off. Whether this will last, I sort of doubt it will last, but hopefully it will last several months into the late spring and early summer.
Well, before I ask for your reasons behind this pessimism over whether this deal would last, Mr. Walsh, do you really think that this deal has gone through with the blessing of the United States?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that no one wants an active bleeding conflict in Ukraine. That serves no one's interests. And so I think definitely the U.S. would like to see a ceasefire and a pause in the action if possible. But that's, I think, President Obama wisely is leaving that to the Europeans, Germany and France in particular. They are the regional neighbors. They are the ones most directly affected. And so I think that's the reason why you see the four-party talks.
Well, that sounds a lot like Obama's usual leading from behind policy. Mr. Billington, your remarks.
Pardon me?
What do you have to say to this, Mr. Billington?
My remarks?
Yep.
Well, I think there's many. I agree basically that this is a very tenuous agreement, and we'll have to see how it proceeds. Keep in mind that this is happening in the midst of a total crisis in Europe because of the Greek vote, where the Syriza party and their independent Greek associates took this election and have declared that they are breaking from the Troika policy, which has brought chaos, virtual genocide to the Greeks, and are in the process of negotiating with an intransigent EU and European Central Bank, who are demanding that they continue imposing these genocidal policies on the Greeks, which they cannot do. The debts cannot be paid. And the danger in the eyes of the financial oligarchs is that the rest of Southern Europe, and even some in Northern Europe, including Spain and Portugal and Italy and Ireland and perhaps even France, if the Greeks pull out of the euro, as they're being forced to do by the intransigent from the EU, it could break up the entire euro. And the impact on this on the U.S. is equally disastrous. The entire massive derivative financial bubble is about to blow apart, far worse than 2007 and 8. And this is the driving force behind this confrontation with Russia. It's not really over Ukraine. I think Mr. Lavrov was correct when he said, or Putin himself said, that if Ukraine hadn't been there, the West would have found some other reason. Remember, this is a 25-year process. The former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Mr. Matlock, just last night here in Washington, said that this has been a process that was launched immediately after the fall of the Soviet Union, where instead of honoring its promise, not written but promised, that NATO would not expand, the U.S. did quite the opposite, the U.S. and the British allies, and have provoked a situation of confrontation for which there was no necessity.